found a text this morning I want to open up with that I think is one that we can remind ourselves of. It's found in the longest psalm ever written, Psalm 119. It's a familiar verse, but it says, "The sum of thy word is truth, and every one of thy righteous ordinances is everlasting." That's the premise we begin with when we go into any discipline, whether it be archaeology, whether it be medicine, whether it be physics or biology or history. God's word is truth. And it's a wonderful lens with which to see the world around us. Talked with one of my creationist friends and a paleontologist a few years ago, and Dr. Elaine Kennedy, and she told me, she says, "You know," she says, "since I've become a Seventh-day Adventist and become a creationist," she says, "I see God in everything around me." As a creationist, paleontologist, and sedimentologist, I guess, is her specialty. Today I'm going to look at, we're moving forward in time, moving forward in history. But before we do that, let's bow our heads for prayer and ask the Lord to be with us as we begin our time this morning. Lord God, we're going to explore the time period of Israel's golden years, the time of David and Solomon, a time when you blessed not only in wisdom, but in wealth and prosperity. And Lord, we pray that we would gain insight as we look at this period of history today and understand your work in our lives as well. In Jesus' name, amen. We're moving through time. We started out exploring the great pyramids of ancient Egypt and the period of the sojourn and then the Exodus. Yesterday we focused on Jericho and the conquest of the land of Canaan. We moved forward not that much time, maybe 50 years or so. Today we're going to jump forward several hundred years to the time of the 10th century and the time of Solomon. Because as we look through this history, there's a great deal of challenges that come our way. Let's look a little bit, first of all, at what archaeology has said about the Age of Solomon, and then look at the history of the discipline as more and more of the Old Testament has literally been eroded away as a historical source of history by scholarship. Back in the early 1900s, the University of Chicago, the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago, began to excavate a very famous site known as in biblical world as Megiddo. Megiddo is a site located here, you can see it, at one end of the Jezreel Valley, guarding the Jezreel Valley. It is the site many believe is maybe the site of Armageddon in the future, that perhaps the word Armageddon comes from the word Megiddo, because there have been so many battles that have been fought around this part of the world. And you know, a few years ago I was there at Megiddo and saw some people camping out. It was the year 2000, and there were people camping out near Megiddo because they believed in 2000 the Lord was coming, and they were going to be there in the Valley of Armageddon to be there for that final battle. I don't know if I would want to be there, but anyway, we know nothing happened. But many people believe this is the place. I think Armageddon is a much broader term as used in the Bible and in the book of Revelation. But nevertheless, this is going back to that time period. Megiddo was an important site throughout the Israelite period. And as the University of Chicago team worked there in the early 1900s, they began to uncover and to find important things. This is the site of Megiddo as it looks today. We're looking down at it. By the way, this is a typical, you see the circle here? This is a typical ancient tell. A tell is a Hebrew or Arabic word that means mound of ruins. You can see there's grass growing over the top of it, isn't there? Sometimes there are orchards that are planted on top of these. Sometimes they're used as agricultural fields. But the fact of the matter is that this hill is an artificial hill. It's an artificial mound that has been built up over the centuries as one city after another has been built on top of the other. People often ask me, well, how is that possible? Well, let's say the city is destroyed by an earthquake or by some invading army, or perhaps somebody knocked over an oil lamp and the whole city caught on fire. Rather than going somewhere else to build a city, they would simply bring in dirt level the area out, fill in the areas where the stubbles of walls used to be, fill up that area with artificial dirt like we would do if we would build a Walmart close by. You know, we bring in fill dirt. They'd make a smooth surface right on top again, and they'd build a new city right on top. Why? Well, they were already close to a good water source normally. They were close to agricultural fields that they had already spent years cultivating and getting rid of the stones and getting rid of the things that were there. They were close to major road junctions that were very important for trade and for connections with other ancient cities. And so there was no reason really to move. Now, there were a few times in history where we know they did move the site. But here, generally, in the Middle East, century after century after century, these places would be occupied and slowly build up so that sometimes you have as many as 18, 20, or 22 cities superimposed on top of the other. And an archaeologist, when you come to a site like this, you begin at the top, at the most recent city, which may date to the Hellenistic period, the time of Alexander the Great, or the Roman period, and you begin to excavate systematically down through those layers. And I tell you, it's a tough thing to do because it's not always as clear, as you're digging, as one might like to think. Sometimes only part of the site was occupied. Sometimes the entire site was occupied during a certain period. And you have to kind of sift through and figure out what was going on here. Well, this part right over here on the lower part of the picture here is not part of the mound. This is the dump of the dirt that was taken out of this trench by the Chicago expedition. Okay, that's the dump. And Megiddo was an important site. Here in this part of the city, right over here, a gate was discovered. An ancient gate, and I'll show you a picture of it here. An ancient gate that had, we're looking from the top down, an ancient gate. This is where's the front of the gate here? This is the front of the gate, the two towers at the front. And these are piers that are extending out, okay, into the area. You would have a set of doors here, gate doors, double set of doors here, doors here, doors here, doors here. Sometimes there was only one set of doors, but each of these rooms here were rooms, chambers. We sometimes call this a six-chamber gate, because if you count, you'll find six chambers there, right? Sometimes we'll call it a four-entryway gate, because there are one, two, three, four entryways into this. This is the most complex gate that's been discovered in Israel during the history of Israelite occupation in this part of the world. The earlier gates from the Canaanites were not as sophisticated. They only had sometimes two entryways, and therefore only one chamber. But these four entryway gates are very, very sophisticated indeed. And when the University of Chicago team excavated this, they didn't really know how to date very well with the pottery typology we talked about earlier. And so in the 1920s and 30s, they simply excavated it and published their reports on it, and that was the end. It wasn't until a few years later when another site was being excavated north of the Sea of Galilee. You see it circled there, Hatzor or Hazor. I like Hatzor because I teach Hebrew, and that's the correct pronunciation in Hebrew. Hazor or Hatzor, this is the biggest Old Testament site in Israel. Okay? And we were going to spend a whole lecture on Friday talking about this site because Southern Adventist University is currently excavating this site in northern Israel. But back in the 1950s, it was the predominant excavation site for the Israelis where all the current senior generation of Israeli archaeologists were trained. And a certain individual by the name of Yigyal Yadin excavated this site. He had great financial support. The Rothschild family supported that excavation. Have you ever heard of the Rothschild family? Yes. This was the Rothschild expedition to Hatzor. And some of you know the author James Michener. He writes these big, huge, epic kind of novels. Well, James Michener came to this site in the 1950s and based an entire book on this site entitled The Source, about archaeology. And if you read that book today, he changed the names of the archaeologists, but if you know the archaeologists who are now mostly retired, you can get to know a little bit about their youthful days getting trained as young students at Hatzor, and he's done a very good job of characterizing them. So this is a very famous site in Israel, very famous site outside of Israel as well, and we're going to spend a whole hour talking about that on Friday in our current excavations there. But in the 1950s, Yadin, who was a professor of archaeology and director of the Institute of Archaeology at the Hebrew University, began his excavations there. Yadin was a very famous archaeologist who continued to excavate at other famous sites like Masada. How many of you have heard of Masada, the fortress of Herod the Great? Tomorrow, I'm going to talk about my excavations at Masada. So the next three lectures, actually, the next three presentations are going to be on stuff that I've been involved with over the years. But he worked here at Hatzor and uncovered, this is Yadin working on one of the Dead Sea Scrolls that we talked about in the presentation yesterday at 2 o'clock. Yadin was a very well-known scholar, later became Deputy Prime Minister of Israel, left academia and went into politics. I don't have any aspirations of that in my career, don't worry. But he did and was a very successful leader, also a very successful general in the Israeli army. You realize when you work in Israel that most of the people you work with are somehow associated with the Israeli military defense forces. Either, you know, you never know what the person is doing. But anyway, many times that's the case. And at Hatzor in the 1950s, lo and behold, he found a gate structure very similar to the one that had been found in the 1930s at Megiddo. Notice this one had towers as well. And here you can see the towers over here. And then in addition, we only have the foundations here, by the way, but we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 chambers. Same kind of structure that we had earlier. Now, I want to share something with you about the function of the gate. What makes this gate structure so important? What makes a gate in ancient Israel so important? It's not only used for defense purposes. Yes, there could be four actual gates, doors here as a major defense into the city. And yes, as one gate was destroyed, there could have been soldiers here ready to defend that gate in each of these chambers. But the gate also served other functions. It was an important meeting place, for you see, the gate area was a big area, and just inside the gate was usually a bigger open area. The Israelite cities were very small, Canaanite cities were very small, with very narrow streets and with houses attached to each other, and so there weren't large public spaces very often, unless it was around a temple or around a gate area, and it was at the gate that many important decisions were made. Think about it. You remember the story of Ruth and Boaz? Where did Boaz go to ask for Ruth's hand in marriage? I mean, after he talked with her, where did he go to speak with the elders of the city? He went to the gate in the city of Bethlehem. And there he met with to see if there were any other kinsmen who would have a claim for Ruth other than himself. Where did Absalom go when he tried to instigate a coup against his father David? He went to the gate of the city of Jerusalem, and there he pronounced judgments upon the people. You remember that? And so the gate... Oh, we can think of another example. Esther. Remember Esther? Esther and her uncle or cousin Mordecai. Where did he hang out in the capital city of Persia in Susa? At the gate. Okay, this is where judicial decisions were made, where financial transactions took place, where all kinds of social things happened. And so it served a much bigger purpose than simply a defensive one in times of war. So as we think about the gates that we're going to talk about today, and we're going to talk about gates today, we need to keep those elements in mind. So Hatzor, Yadin found this gate. And he was excited because as he found the gate and as he began to excavate the pottery associated with the gate, he found a certain kind of pottery called red-slipped and burnished ware. And this red-slipped burnished ware, it's got a red sheen and it's burnished with a stone to give it a nice shiny look to it. It's hand burnished. He recognized that this dated, according to the chronologies that they had back in the 50s, to the 10th century. And that reminded him of a verse in the Bible. And so he went to 1 Kings chapter 9:15, a verse that he knew quite well, and he remembered an event that happened in the reign of Solomon. Notice what it says here. And this is the reason for the labor force which King Solomon raised. To build what? the house of the Lord. We know Solomon built the temple in Jerusalem. To build his own house, okay, the palace that he would live in Jerusalem, the Milo, and don't ask me what the Milo means. There's a huge bit of discussion about that. We really don't know today what that is. But notice what else he rebuilt. The wall of what? Jerusalem, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Now, Megiddo had already been excavated by the Chicago team. He was currently excavating Hazor, and he thought, this is the wall and the gate that Solomon rebuilt and refortified the city with. It dates, according to the pottery, to the right time. And he wrote in an article published in 1957 in the Biblical Archaeologist, he wrote in an article about these gates, he made a prediction. Now, predictions are very difficult for you and I to make, aren't they? It's one thing for a prophet to make a prediction, inspired by God. It's another thing for you and I to make a prediction. But he made a prediction based on this verse. He said, I predict that the individuals who excavate the city of Gezer, that's how I pronounce this word, not geezer, that has other connotations. So, Gezer, he says, the person who excavates, the team that excavates Gezer in the future, I predict will find a gate in similar structure dating to the same time period. Now, does that make sense? Based on the chronology and based on this biblical verse. And lo and behold, sure enough, in the 1960s and 70s, when Harvard University and the Hebrew Union College teams began to excavate at Gezer under the leadership of Dr. William G. Deaver, they uncovered a similar gate structure. Here it is, 1968 to 1974. This gate actually had benches inside each of the chambers. You see, these are the six chambers here. This is the towers on the front of the gate. These actually had benches, which again goes to show that this was a, what? Had another function besides simply to be a defensive function. And the archaeologist, William G. Deaver, in his publications on this said, Yadin was absolutely right. These are the gates of Solomon because the same pottery was found here as had been found at Hazor and at Megiddo. In fact, Yadin was so convinced of his theory that he went back to Megiddo in the 1960s and he re-excavated the gate at Megiddo to tighten the chronology there from the early Chicago excavations that had taken place. Now that's the way the picture looked in the 1970s and 1980s. And there was a consensus that developed around archaeology that the time period of Solomon and David were securely fixed archaeologically now with these discoveries at these major sites. Jerusalem, by the way, you're probably wondering about the text, what about Jerusalem? Because Jerusalem was also listed there. The problem with Jerusalem is it's still occupied today. And it's occupied by two different ethnic groups. And there's a lot of politics because of that. Arabs and Jews are both living in that part of the world. And because of that, excavations in Jerusalem are limited. Why? Well, you've got to destroy somebody's house in order to excavate beneath it, right? Actually, there's some people who have actually dug in their basements. Did you know that? And have found all kinds of fantastic things down below, underneath where they live. There's actually some museums that have been established underneath the homes of some of the wealthy Jewish families that are living in the old city. But nevertheless, this is not a very easy place to excavate because of that continual occupation over time in Jerusalem. So Jerusalem we really don't know as much about, certainly not as much about the walls and so forth. Now, I'm going to take a little bit of a time with you today to review with you a little bit some of the things that we've talked about yesterday and throughout these days. There has been a trend over the history of scholarship in the last 20th century, a trend to deny more and more of biblical history in the Old Testament as time has gone on. And I just want to share that a little bit with you. Yesterday we learned about Martin Noth and Albrecht Az, the two German scholars who undermined the historicity of the patriarchs and even the Exodus and conquest, but primarily they can be credited, and the German critics of the 19th century can be credited with disregarding any kind of historicity to creation, flood, patriarchs, the time period of Abraham and so forth. Not so much that, primarily this and this. And there was a huge backlash. Remember we talked about that yesterday? In the 1930s and 40s, an American school of biblical archaeology was formed by William F. You remember the names. Albright, Wright, Bright. You remember that? The Albright, Wright, Bright School. Okay? Albright teaching at Johns Hopkins University, Wright teaching at Harvard University, Bright teaching at a major seminary here in the United States. Here's Albright, William F. Albright. Albright was a genius of a scholar. He published more than any other scholar has ever published in this discipline. He was fluent in more than a dozen languages, and not only ancient languages, and not only fluent in them, he was able to publish authoritatively in each area and discipline. Today, in our world, we become more specialized and more specialized as knowledge increases. And it's an unfortunate thing, because we become maybe the world's expert in about this much, you know. But to make interconnections with what's happening in the rest of the world during this time becomes increasingly difficult because of our specialization. Albright was probably one of the last, he was a genius, no question about it, one of the last individuals who really could master a great deal. Of course, today, we know much more. We have much more to deal with than Albright had to deal with in his time. But he was an amazing, amazing scholar. Several of our Seventh-day Adventist scholars went to do their PhDs at Johns Hopkins under Albright. You may know some of them. Leona Running taught biblical languages at Andrews University for many, many years. She sent me a note a few years ago at Southern. She says, "Say hello to my former students there." I think everybody that went through the seminary over a period of 40 years was probably her student. Barry, you're nodding your head back there. Yeah. Amazing person. You took Hebrew from her and you realized that Hebrew was just the introduction to a huge world of ancient Semitic languages that you had no idea about, because she would refer to Ugaritic and Syriac and all of these things, and kept everybody, she had the nickname, well, she had the last name Running, but she kept everybody going, okay, all the time. She was a student under him, and another scholar, Alger Johns, also studied under Albright. Siegfried Horn, the major archaeologist in the Adventist Church and former dean of the seminary up at Andrews, went to Albright, so the story goes, to study under Albright there later in his life when he got into archaeology. And Albright gave everybody kind of a personal test, kind of an entrance exam. And in that entrance exam, he would sit them down in his office and have them read orally from the Hebrew Bible and from the Greek, and ask them questions and so forth. And so the story goes, Siegfried Horn, after he was done with that hour interview, or whatever, however long it was, Albright said to him, "Sir, I cannot teach you anything else. I want you to go to the University of Chicago's Oriental Institute and do a PhD in Egyptology. That might be a good thing for you to do." And so Siegfried Horn left Johns Hopkins and did precisely that, and became a very well-known teacher and scholar in the Adventist Church. Nelson Gluck from the Hebrew Union College, another major figure in the biblical archaeology movement, and G. Ernest Wright. Albright, Wright, Bright. We talked about these three fellows. G. Ernest Wright taught a number of Adventist scholars at Harvard University over the years. And so Albright basically grew up in the German critical tradition, but then after some time, especially after visiting Palestine and getting involved in archaeology, rejected many of the conclusions that the German scholars had come up with. And this is what he writes in one of his early books, The Archaeology of Palestine. "It is accordingly sheer hypercriticism to deny substantially the Mosaic character of the Pentateuchal tradition." In other words, Albright is saying, let's not deny that Moses wrote the Pentateuch, the first five books. There's too much evidence archaeologically to support many of the events that are talked about there. He believed in the patriarchs and the patriarchal period. He believed in the conquest and the Exodus. And he, over the period of his lifetime until his death in the 1970s, was vigorously working against the German scholars and others who were arguing against this. Now, it was in the 1970s, shortly after Albright's death, that two books came out within 1 year of each other. Abraham in History and Tradition, and another one, The Historicity of the Patriarchal Narratives. Both of them attacked any kind of archaeological connection between Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the patriarchal background to the Old Testament. And with these two books, scholars began to become more skeptical of the period of the patriarchs. I'm just sharing this with you because we're moving on through time here, aren't we? And I want to show you from the area of scholarship what's happening as we also are entering into the end time. Do you believe we're entering into the end time? And do you believe that Satan will work more and more to undermine the Bible as we move into that end time? Well, it's happening, and it has happened. As I've looked at this, we are seeing it happening before our eyes. These two books, basically, for the secular scholarly community and for many Christian biblical scholars out there, put a huge question around Abraham and around this period of history. So that's the 70s. So here we have a systematic attack against different things. In the 1980s, the big issue, actually it started in 1977 with an article, but in the 1980s, here in the United States, the whole concept of what? The Exodus and the conquest began to be attacked. And we mentioned that in our lectures yesterday and the day before. So we see that today this has become a very contested period, but many scholars, as we quoted one yesterday, Robert Coote, remember him? This is not even part of the history that I'm going to talk about in terms of where early Israel came from. But in the 1990s, the area that came heavily under attack was the period of the United Monarchy. And that's the period that we're going to be talking about today. The publication of Philip Davies' book that I mentioned a couple of days ago at 2 o'clock, In Search of Ancient Israel, and a number of other books that have come out since that time. Philip Davies wrote in 1992, "The Israel of the biblical literature is, at least for the most part, not an historical entity at all." He goes on in his book to say that David and Solomon are no more historical than King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, or the King Curtis, this guy's British, so he's using British examples, or the King Curtises of history, that these are mythical figures that may have a little kernel of truth somewhere in them, but the stories around them are nothing more than myth. That ancient Israel is nothing more than a myth, and that the concept of Israel, according to Philip Davies, was not invented until the Hellenistic period, the time of Alexander the Great, hundreds of years after the time of David and Solomon. So that's what we're facing today. In fact, as more and more histories of Israel have come out, the trend is that the period of David and Solomon is not even treated anymore as a historical period. The final book that I quoted from the other day, Can a History of Israel Be Written?, answers the question, no, it cannot. The period of David and Solomon are not even under question anymore. They're even going beyond that into history. Gary Knoppers, in the major journal in biblical studies, the Journal of Biblical Literature, wrote this in 1997, describing this crisis concerning the United Monarchy. He said, three decades ago, before 1997, scholars viewed the United Monarchy as one of the most secure periods of historical reconstruction. Why? Precisely because of the archaeological finds that had been made at these sites. Virtually all modern historians wrote histories that included, if not commenced with, the monarchy of David and Solomon. This is no longer the case. And Knoppers goes on to document why that is so and what the scholars are saying today. Now, Gezer, in the late 80s and then primarily in the late 80s, had also come under criticism. Gezer, Hazor, Megiddo, this concept that these three cities were Solomonic or that they had Solomonic rebuildings of walls and gates, all of that came under criticism by a couple of newer archaeologists to the field, one of whose name was Israel Finkelstein. Finkelstein is currently director of the Institute of Archaeology at Tel Aviv University. He's a very well-published scholar. He is an excellent archaeologist. But in his view, he has championed what has been called the low chronology, basically redating these gates to the time of Ahab and later, and thereby removing any kind of monumental architecture or monumental building from the time period of Solomon. I was on the web yesterday. One of my board members from the Institute of Archaeology Advisory Board contacted me, and he says, "You've got to see this article, Wall Street Journal." So I read it this morning. Was on the Wall Street Journal yesterday. Okay? And it again quoted Israel Finkelstein, because there's been a remarkable new find that has just taken place in the area of Edom. You know that there were three major territories in Jordan that the Israelites also were said to conquer: Ammon, Moab, and Edom. And most scholars today say Edom wasn't even around during the time period of the early Israelite united monarchy, that Edom didn't develop until way later as an entity that could be reckoned with. These were just nomadic tribes that didn't have any centralized government. Well, Thomas Levy, an archaeologist at the University of California, San Diego, just published and just came out with an amazing new discovery in the territory of Edom, where he has uncovered a large fortress with huge amounts of slag from copper smelting. We know that copper was being mined in these places. And he has dated this stuff, some of his material, and he's arguing that Edom existed and had to have some kind of a united system of government in order to produce this volume of copper. There had to be some political organization, and he's arguing that Edom existed already in the 12th century, 200 years before David and Solomon, and definitely could have been a political rival during that time. This is right now in Wall Street Journal, and it's coming out on all the Barnes & Noble and Borders bookstores in the magazine Biblical Archaeology Review. So if you want to pick up a copy of Biblical Archaeology Review on the newsstands, you can see this latest article. It's already received tremendous criticism from other archaeologists who don't believe that stuff existed. But Thomas Levy, also trained at the University of Arizona, where I graduated from, is a fine archaeologist, and has stuck his neck out to say, "Hey, we've got evidence in Edom from our excavations showing this is the case." Hot off the press, I just read it this morning. Now, Gezer, the site that had been critiqued quite a bit, Professor William Deaver decided it was time to go back to Gezer and re-excavate the gate in order to answer some of the criticisms that had been brought by some of the Israeli scholars like Finkelstein and Yushishkin and others. I remember being at a conference with my father in 1990 at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And there Dr. Deaver and Dr. Yushishkin were debating the issue of the dates of these gates. And I remember as a young student sitting there in the front row listening to these two great archaeologists, you know, speaking with each other. And Dr. Deaver finally stopped and pointed over to me and says, "He's going to be with me this summer excavating. He's going to find what truly happened." And I kind of sat there with fear and trembling with all these scholars. I was just a college student at the time, you know. But this was my first experience excavating in the Middle East, and I was able to excavate with one of the finest American archaeologists, Dr. William Deaver, who was head of the largest graduate program in Near Eastern archaeology for many, many years here in this country at the University of Arizona. He went back in 1990, a joint project sponsored by the University of Arizona and Andrews University. And to me, it's exciting to see when we can go together and work with other scholars, because I believe that when we work with other people, when we mingle with other people, we can make an impact with other people, can't we? When we stay to ourselves, we're not able to do that. But when we mingle and work with other people, God can use us in those endeavors. I want to share with you what happened in 1990 during this summer at Gezer. This is the site of Gezer looking across the fertile plains of the southern coastal area of Israel. Gezer is located on this natural hill and then was built up also as a mound. We excavated in this area that you can see doesn't have any vegetation on it. We had to get rid of the vegetation first. Boy, was that a job. This is what the gate looked like when we got there. I mean, it was completely covered up with weeds. It hadn't been excavated for a while, for years. And so when we arrived there, the first job that we had to do, I don't tell my students this usually because it kind of takes away from the excitement and the mystery of archaeology, you know. But the first job we had to do was gardening work. We had to weed the whole place. Okay, and for for a whole day we had a weed, and I was stuck down here in the sewer system, the sewer drain that ran out the gate of the city. And I was down there pulling weeds all day, and didn't realize it until later that, because this was my first time excavating in Israel. I'd been to Israel once before, but my first time excavating, twice before, that there are poisonous snakes in Israel. Well, there's one kind of poisonous snake called a Palestinian viper. And luckily I didn't see one, but I was told that they could nest in those kinds of places down there, and they only told me that after the fact. Well, after that particular day was over, this is what it looked like. We had done our weeding, we had done our job. Here's that trench that runs out. You can see it down here, running out of the old city. This is the street level up here. The street, much of it has been destroyed. Here you can see the piers of the gates, okay, of the gate coming out. And this is one of the chambers, another chamber. You see here, this is the bench inside. Here, somebody's actually sitting on the bench right here as they're working inside this area. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4 piers, 1, 2, 3 chambers on each side. Here's the other piers on the other side. And here is the entrance. Okay, so people would have come up the city this way, entered in this way into the city. This is the area. There's a nice water basin, a stone water basin over here as well. We don't know what that was used for, well, but undoubtedly as people came into the city from long journeys, they were thirsty, their animals were thirsty. Probably wasn't used for both. But anyway, we can only guess many times as we look at these things. So the goal to do, what we wanted to do here was, you see, the gate had been excavated very, very well in the 60s and 70s, but the issue with chronology is that you don't really know for certain how to date something until you go down below something, because it is in the relationship of what is below it, which is earlier, right? The principle of superimposition. That which is below is older than that which is above, okay, because they were building one on top of. I mean, it seems like such a simple principle, but Flinders Petrie, who came up with that idea, thought that he was such a genius for coming up with it back in the 1800s, that he, upon his death, well, before his death, willed that his brain be pickled and placed in the British Academy of Sciences for later study, because he was such an incredible genius, and it is still there today. But at any rate, Petrie was a very interesting fellow, and we don't need to get into him right now. What do you say? Geniuses are usually called eccentric, right? So he was very eccentric. But at any rate, the first thing we needed to do was go down below in order to figure out what the sequence of chronology was. What pottery was down below? See, Deaver had never dug down below before, and that was one of the big criticisms that we had. So in this area where these two individuals are, and back in here, we wanted to dig down below these foundations, and see what lay down below. Now, in order to figure out what was happening here, we also have to go back to the biblical text, because the biblical text gives us some important information for chronology for Gezer. Notice what it says. We just read 1 Kings 9:15, but in 1 Kings 9:16, the next verse, there is something, usually in parentheses in your Bible, that deals with the history of this site of Gezer. It talks about, you know, what did it talk about? Jerusalem, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer, the cities that were refortified. And then it says this, the Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and taken Gezer and had burned it with fire. Archaeologically, is that significant? Yes, because it gives us a burnt destruction layer to look for. And we can find burnt destruction layers in the archaeological record. Okay, so Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and taken Gezer and burned it with fire. He had killed the Canaanites who dwelt in the city, and had then, after he burns it with fire and killed all the Canaanites, what had he done? He had given it as a dowry to his daughter, Solomon's wife. How would you like that? I wonder how much politics was involved in that marriage. Whether it was a marriage of love. We know Solomon was married to a lot of people, and had a lot of concubines, but certainly a city is not a bad dowry, is it? How would you like that? You marry my daughter, I will give you the city of Philadelphia. Or I will give you the city of
New York.
Well, Gezer was not quite that large, but certainly was a prosperous city. And the fact of the matter is, when you go back to Joshua in the book of Judges, you will find that the Israelites never conquered Gezer because of their fear for the Canaanites that dwelt there. So Gezer, throughout the period of the conquest and throughout this time period, for the last 400 years until the reign of Solomon, had not been in Israelite hands. It had been in Canaanite hands. Okay? Pharaoh, king of Egypt, okay, now takes this city, burns it. Now that's a problem, you know. Thanks a lot. You know, you're giving me a burned city? Is it a dowry? You know? Why didn't you give me the city before you burnt it? You know, that might have been a little bit more valuable. But he gives it nevertheless, and it is on that premise that the city is then rebuilt and refortified under Solomon. Now, so what can we expect to find underneath the gate? If the gate does date to Solomon's time period, and he rebuilt that gate, what can we expect to find underneath the gate? A burnt destruction layer, right? Now, the problem with burnt destruction layers is this. The problem is that most of the time, we don't have a nice little piece of cuneiform tablet or a nice piece of written thing saying, I, Sayamun, the king of Egypt, burnt this city to the ground and gave it as a dowry to Solomon's wife. We don't usually have that kind of evidence. It would be nice if we did. So just because you find a destruction level doesn't necessarily mean, I'm just sharing this with you in general, doesn't necessarily mean that it was the destruction of that particular king or that it didn't happen some other way. Now, I have spent quite a bit of time looking at how we can assess destruction levels. And I think one of the things we have to do is ask the question, how did various governments and various military groups interact when they went on military campaigns? Did they destroy cities? We talked about that yesterday in relation to Jericho and the conquest. But did they do that on a regular basis? We know the Assyrians did. We know the Assyrians not only burnt a city to the ground, but then razed it to the ground and rebuilt it from scratch. That's what the Assyrians would do. We know that certain groups did that, but other groups did not. And so it's important. Here we have biblical evidence that he did burn it with fire. Unfortunately, we don't know who the Pharaoh is. One of those frustrating things again. Why didn't they just name the Pharaoh involved? But we know Solomon, and we know that in the fifth year after Solomon's death, when Rehoboam, his son, is in power, Shishak, the king of Egypt, and here we do have the name given in the Bible, comes in and campaigns throughout Israel and throughout Judah. In fact, the Bible tells us that he takes all the temple treasures and takes them back to Egypt with him. All of Solomon's gold is taken. I wish I had time to share with you that lecture. I've got a lecture entitled, What Happened to Solomon's Gold? It's a kind of a neat lecture, but we won't have time for it here. Have to come to Southern and take a class sometime. So, the Sayamun destruction. We could imagine Sayamun would be the logical pharaoh, because we know Shishak comes in the fifth year after Solomon's reign. So, we could expect a destruction before the gate, okay, probably dating to Sayamun. And sure enough, that's exactly what we found. As we excavated down, we found a destruction layer. This whole dark area here that you see is destruction. This here is charcoal, burnt charcoal from one of the beams, probably that fell. We have that destruction. We have a destruction there just below the gate. The gate level, by the way, is just about right up here. Okay, so we're going down below. And we have found very important pottery indications that this pottery that we're looking at here is definitely 10th century pottery, definitely comes from the time of Solomon. And so that helped us in the chronology as well. That was very, very important. So we have the Sayamun destruction. We have the gate on top of the Sayamun destruction. And then, of course, from earlier excavations, we know that there's another destruction that destroyed the gate. And that destruction has been, we also found part of that destruction here again as we worked outside of the gate. That destruction has been identified with Shishak or Shoshank I, the king of Egypt. I just was at Karnak in Egypt and saw Shishak's big inscription there on the wall at Karnak, where he describes his campaign against Israel and against Judah. Jerusalem is not mentioned as a conquered city, but most of the blocks from the top of the inscription are missing. They're gone. So it could have been listed on top. But Shishak definitely campaigned in this area at the site of Megiddo, in the dump that the University of Chicago left there, the one I showed you. A inscription from Shishak was found, part of a stela, part of a basalt stela, and his cartouche and his name is there. So we know he went as far as Megiddo and probably erected a victory stela there, as many of the Egyptian pharaohs did. So this is what we found surrounding the gate, and it was very, very exciting to be involved in those excavations and find that. Another thing that was very important was the ashlar masonry. Do we have any masons here that work with buildings and things? Look at the stones that, well, these are not really stones, these are bricks, but they're nice and smooth, aren't they? Before this time period, at least in Israel, most of the walls were built with field stones. They were not built with nicely hewn stones. But Solomon does something. You remember in 1 Kings 5, Solomon has been asked by God to build the temple. He's been asked by God to build the most important structure that probably ever was built in the ancient Near East for the God of heaven. And what does he do? Do you remember where he went? He went up to Phoenicia and hired people. Let's read it here in 1 Kings 5. Now King Solomon levied forced laborers from all Israel, and the forced laborers numbered 30,000 men. And he sent them to where?
Lebanon.
To Lebanon. Okay, ancient Phoenicia. Then the king commanded, and they quarried great stones, costly stones, to lay the foundation of the house with what? Cut stones. The Bible is very clear on this. So Solomon's builders and Hiram's builders, Hiram was the king of Tyre, up in Phoenicia, and the Gebalites cut them and prepared the timbers and the stones to build the house. Solomon not only gets together with Hiram and Tyre and brings down cedars of Lebanon, but he brings down artisans to teach his people how to build. You see, in that particular period of history, the Phoenicians were the master craftsmen of the ancient world, of the Eastern Mediterranean world. I was just in Cyprus a few days ago, and on the island of Cyprus, located in the Mediterranean, we have Phoenician influence there as well. We have buildings, Phoenician buildings that are built there. We have Phoenician buildings going all the way through the Levant and so forth. So this is what happened. A few years ago, I was in Brazil. I'm going to be there next week, actually. I leave on Tuesday for Brazil. But I remember a few years ago when I was there, and my wife and I went to some of the resort towns there, some of the old historical cities that date back to the 1800s, to the first European settlers that settled in Brazil. And we found there in Brazil, all of a sudden we're coming out of this valley and into this area, and there is a beautiful building there that looks like it was just transplanted from Versailles in France and placed in Brazil. I mean, it looked so out of place. I said, what on earth is this structure? What's it doing here? You know? And we began to ask around the townspeople. They said, French architects and French artisans were brought over to Brazil to build this building back in the 1800s. I said, really? Well, and what was the purpose of the building? Oh, the purpose of the building was to be a casino, gambling place. I said, oh. I said, and was it ever used as one? They said, no, it was never used as one, because the month that the building was finished, the country of Brazil outlawed gambling. So there it stood next to this beautiful, beautiful lake. But, you know, we still do that today. We bring the master builders, you know, and we bring them. That's what Solomon did. He knew that his people could not do the kind of work that needed to be done. And he found the best builders in the territory to come and do the work, Phoenicians. And so here at Gezer, we have these hewn stones, this header stretcher kind of style of building. Beautiful, beautiful. Yes, we've got chinking stones in between. Of course, all of this would have been beautifully plastered afterwards and nicely done. This is very, very unusual for this time period in ancient Israel. Very unique. Now, there was another master builder, Ahab. And Finkelstein and Yushishkin and others had argued that Ahab was the one that built these walls. that it wasn't Solomon. And so that was what we were trying to do along the outer walls of the city. Here's the gate that I was talking about, right over here. And we went to field 11 up here to actually excavate the walls of the city and to look at these towers, because it was believed that these towers probably were placed there by Solomon as he refortified the city after the event. So we went, and here is Penny Clifford, one of the doctoral students at Arizona, pointing to one of these towers, one of these buildings. She's actually pointing to a crack in it. I can't get into that today. I have a whole nother lecture on something completely unexpected that we found. We found earthquake evidence. The earthquake evidence here at this city, which Bill Deaver believes was the earthquake mentioned in Amos 1:1. Do you know that the entire book of Amos is dated to an earthquake? The entire book of Amos. Read it sometime, Amos 1:1. Anyway, that's another interesting confirmation to the biblical text that we had. So here we found this wall, but as we excavated down around the wall, we couldn't get very much new material. You know why? There was an archaeologist by the name of McAllister, an Irish archaeologist that worked at Gezer back in the early 1900s and had excavated the site. His method of excavation was this. He would hire a couple hundred Arab workmen. They would come in and they would dig a trench from here to the doors over there. Okay? Just a huge trench, and they would dig it all the way down to bedrock. And when they were done recording the walls that were in there, this was in the early 1900s when archaeology was maybe nothing more than treasure hunting, they would come and go right next to it. They would backfill the entire trench and dig another one and systematically work through the site. So they did that with a huge portion of the site of Gezer. And everywhere we went, we found McAllister's dump. And we didn't like McAllister very much after that season. I mean, you spend so much time digging and only to find dump, only to find stuff that you can't use and nothing new. It's not very good. So all on the inside of the wall here, on the inside part, all we found was McAllister's dump. All this stuff here was McAllister's dump. He had already recorded these walls. And in fact, in the previous slide here, this is part of his map. He had outlined this wall here and then filled in the rest. Okay, so he had gone along all these walls, trenched all along them, and figured out what was there. So we brought in something unusual. I told you yesterday that we don't work with bulldozers. Well, this time we did. Now, Bill Deaver, you have to understand, is one of the most published archaeologists in the country today and one of the most respected for the technique. If Hatzor was the major site that trained the senior generation of Israeli archaeologists, Gezer was the primary site that trained the senior generation of American archaeologists in the 1960s and 70s. All of the major archaeologists, Larry Steger, who teaches at Harvard University now and will soon retire, was trained at Gezer. Joe Seeger at Mississippi State, all of these guys were trained here at Gezer and were directing Gezer. And William Deaver, as a young student, was also a director and worked here at Gezer. And so he's coming back now in 1990 to look at all these things. We decided to bring in a bulldozer and only to work through the material that was disturbed. And as we worked down the face of the outside of the wall, we went to the outside of the wall, we discovered the wall here. You can see it's all made of unhewn stones, pretty much. And then we came to this at the bottom. This is dirt. The wall stops right here. Now, the interior of the wall stops at bedrock. This part of the wall stops here. And I still remember how disappointed we were, because we didn't have a lot of time left. It was a 5.5-week season, and we were already... we only had about 2 weeks left to go, a week and a half to 2 weeks left to go. We were coming to the end of our season. We couldn't do a lot more. And I remember that night taking the pottery from this wall, from the material that we were excavating there. Now we were working by hand. You can see the labels up here. We were working by hand and doing nice sections on either side and collecting all the pottery. That night as we went back to look at the pottery, here's Dr. Deaver. And he is, and that's me actually, a few years ago before my prematuring gray hair. And we're reading the pottery. How do you read pottery? Well, you pick up the pieces and you look at the rims and you're able to date these things. And we were coming up with nothing earlier than the 8th and 9th centuries. And Dr. Deaver was so disappointed. I still remember him that afternoon, so disappointed. And he said, well, he said in a very despondent voice, he said to us from Andrews, he says, I don't know what God you believe in or want to pray to, but if you believe in anything about prayer, or you might as well pray to some God, whether it's Asherah or Baal. He says, I don't care, but pray to some God, because if ever we needed prayer, this is the time we need prayer. And it was kind of a sarcastic remark, as you can tell. But you see, Dr. Deaver, for 17 years of his life, had been a minister of the gospel in a Protestant denomination, but today is an agnostic. And over the years, we've had a lot of good contacts with Dr. Deaver. We've worked together. There's been a number of students studying with him. This, again, was a team of Arizona students coming from a major state university, one of the top 15 research universities, and Andrews coming together to work together. You know, sometimes you take these comments and you just simply shrug them off and go home for the day, but we didn't. Because when somebody says we should pray, right? And there were a number of us that night that got together in small groups and prayed about this situation. Because whatever we do in life, whatever occupation we're in, prayer works, and prayer is something that we need to be engaged in. And we prayed, Lord, you know the challenge that has been presented to us. You know what is at stake here. Give us wisdom to know what to do. And at that moment, that evening, Randy Yonker, who was the co-director of the excavation, professor of archaeology at Andrews, one of Deaver's archaeology students, decided to go and talk to Dr. Deaver and to ask him to hire the bulldozer for one more day. Because you know what the dictum is in archaeology. Unless you go down, you don't know what lies below, right? So he says, hire the bulldozer for one more day. Dr. Deaver says, we don't have enough money. Bulldozer costs this and this much money a day. We don't have enough money. We've run out of time. It's obvious we're at the bottom of the wall. There's nothing more to look for. But Randy was persistent, and finally Dr. Deaver relented. Okay, we'll rent it for half a day tomorrow. So the bulldozer came back. I know this is the same picture, but it's for dramatic effect. The bulldozer came back and began digging the following day to go a little bit lower. We didn't have much time, and we needed to get some work done. And lo and behold, this is what we found. First of all, we found pottery that is much earlier than the 8th or 9th century. This is a late Bronze Age piece of pottery that dates to the time right after the conquest. Okay? Or during the conquest, that period of between 1400 and 1200 BC. That's what that dates to. And this is where we stopped digging the day before. There's the dirt. See it? And look what we found below. Another huge extent of wall. Huge extent of wall. So this is what was up above, 8th century, Hellenistic. The plaster covers up part of this 8th century wall. Then we found a bit of wall here, probably dating to the 10th century. And then all of this down here, dating all the way down. This was solid late Bronze Age pottery all the way down. So the wall, we know, this did several things. It not only confirmed that the city of Gezer was walled during the time of Solomon, it also confirmed that the city of Gezer was walled during the time that the Israelites were in that part of the world during the conquest. Because after all, the Egyptian records had described Gezer as being walled. And certainly now we had evidence for that as well here. The Israelites were afraid to take Gezer for some reason. Certainly were afraid for some reason. Now you can see Dr. Deaver taking pictures here, and I'm up on the ladder putting up all the little tags to label everything and so forth. This was exciting stuff. I cannot tell you for a young college student how exciting it was for me. I still remember when Dr. Deaver at supper one night asked me, he says, Michael, he says, I understand you're interested in archaeology as a professional career. We were eating dinner one evening after a hard day's work. I said, yes, I am. He says, have you ever thought about the University of Arizona? One of the top two schools in the country to study Near Eastern archaeology. Arizona and Harvard, two big competitors. I said, yes, of course. I said, with Harvard, of course. You know, shouldn't have said that. Don't say that. Oh, Harvard, he says, I went to school there years ago. He says, it was a great school then, but it's not what it used to be. And he went on, you know, to sell his program, and he says, why don't you come and study with me at Arizona? Well, isn't there an application process involved? Oh, there is, but I'm the chair of the committee. I mean, this was my junior year in college, you know, so I'm sitting there with him, my fork is about halfway to my mouth, and it just kind of has frozen there, you know. And I said, that's very generous of you. He says, well, what's your GPA? And I told him, and he says, and have you taken the GRE yet? No, not yet. Well, you'll need to do that. He says, what is funding like there? And he says, we have several different scholarships available. He says, but don't worry, he says, I'm the chairman of the committee. So I had a personal invitation. You know, three amazing things happened that summer. I just have to tell you how the Lord worked. Three amazing things happened. I went call portering in New Jersey, and that confirmed my call to ministry. It was a wonderful experience, call portering outside of Newark, New Jersey, that particular summer before I left for the dig. And while I was call portering, I met my wife, Giselle, who gave me a tour, me and my call portering partner, a tour through the city of New York, which I had not really seen before. And I met Dr. Deaver and got an invitation to study at the University of Arizona that summer at Gezer. It was a very formidable time of life. But certainly it was amazing. One day, I just have to tell you the story, one day Dr. Deaver called me and said, Michael, let's go up to the site and let's draw the section. You see here I'm putting up labels. There was obviously somebody else up here, but this time it was only two of us. You see the wall over here? All of these are layers that need to be drawn, carefully measured and drawn. And the other wall is the more important one. That's the one he's taking pictures of. You can't see it right now. So I went and I was the measuring guy while he was the drawing guy doing all the drawings. And I remember being up there with him, and I remember him saying to me, you know, Michael, he says, I grew up believing and being taught all the things that you were taught. He says, my dad was a minister in the hills of Tennessee. He was a fire and brimstone fundamentalist preacher. He says, and I was taught not to gamble, and I still don't gamble to this day because it's a waste of money. He says, I was taught, not to smoke, and I don't smoke to this day because it kills you. He says, I was taught not to go to movies. And I kind of looked at him, you know, where did he get that from? But that's what he said. He says, I was taught not to go to movies, and I don't go to movies to this day because it's a waste of time. And then he was quiet for a moment. He says, I guess I never really understood why. And it was one of those moments, you know, as a young college student, what do you say? So I was quiet and I listened. And I was praying inside, of course. But that was only one of many similar kinds of conversations we were to have over the next several years as I worked with him at the University of Arizona. A man who lost his faith but was still desperately searching for something to hold on to. At any rate, there we were. There were the walls. And it was exciting. Now, what happens on an archaeological dig when you make a major discovery, whether you do or don't, what happens on archaeological digs is that you visit all the other archaeological digs that are going on at the same time, and they all happen during the summer, usually, in that part of the world. And the reason is because what I said yesterday, remember? What happens to archaeological reports? They don't get published until when? Often after people die, okay? So if you want to see what's happening in the field, you better be in the field to see what's happening and hear it from the archaeologists' mouths themselves. There are preliminary scientific reports that come out and so forth, and some are better than others in getting their stuff out, but it usually takes years to see what you can see in one summer going around. So that's why I go to Israel every year and visit the sites and look at what's going on, because that's how you keep in touch of what's going on. So all the archaeologists came, and Dr. Deaver had an ingenious plan. It wasn't my plan. It wasn't Dr. Yonker's plan. It was his plan to play a little joke on the visiting archaeologists. Well, here they came. Lawrence Steger, professor of archaeology at Harvard University, one of Deaver's old companions. Both had worked at Gezer years earlier. Jane Waldbaum, who currently is the president of the American Institute of Archaeology, located out of Boston, a very well-known archaeologist. She's known as Iron Jane, not because she's made of iron, but because her specialty is on ancient iron implements. And this gentleman, who unfortunately now has passed away, Professor Benjamin Mazar, who at this time was in his 80s, one of the deans of biblical archaeology, a student of Albright's many years earlier, who was very influential in Israeli archaeology in the early years of its development, all standing here. And Dr. Deaver is standing there at the center in the beige. Here, Israel Finkelstein came. There he is. And all of his students from Tel Aviv University. And this is what Dr. Deaver decided to do. He decided to cover up with a huge cloth the lower portion of the wall that we found. And here he is telling Dr. Finkelstein, he's saying, you know, Dr. Finkelstein, you are absolutely right. As we were excavating this wall, look, it stops here. And what we found was only 8th century material and some 9th century material. You were right. The wall dates to the time of Ahab and later. And look at the smirk on Finkelstein's face. We got this picture just at the time he was saying this, you know. And he's just enjoying it. See, he's just smiling, you know, he's got his arms crossed. He says, I can see this in publication now, you know. And Deaver's saying, oh, you were absolutely right. You see him there? And this is the crazy thing, I was the guy holding the cloth. I was, you know, maybe because I'd become so adept at climbing that ladder, as you saw before, but I was the guy holding the cloth. And then Deaver said, Michael, drop the cloth. And I dropped it. And look at his face now. As Dr. Deaver explains and points out the stratigraphy and the late Bronze Age pottery all the way up this wall, and how this wall is very ancient and is much older than the 8th or 9th century. Pardon? How many feet the entire wall? Probably about, I would say, 18 feet maybe. Yeah. We had one close call, by the way. Somebody was working on top and one of the stones from the top fell down while we were down there. It missed Dr. Deaver by only a little bit. And that would have been very dangerous, of course. So you have to be careful about these kinds of things. Now, has Israel Finkelstein changed his mind? No, he hasn't changed his mind. But Dr. Deaver published in the leading journal in our field, the journal entitled The Bulletin of the American Schools of Oriental Research, this in 1993 as the report of our excavations there that summer. He says, the completed stratigraphic cut, this cut that we made outside the wall through all the layers, all the stratigraphy there, and the section through the casemate wall, thus provides a glimpse of the entire history of the Iron Age at Gezer, including all 3 destructions. Because you see, Gezer was destroyed also by Tiglath-Pileser III, another king that's mentioned in the Bible. Tiglath-Pileser III, the Assyrian king. So what he's referring to, all 3 destructions, Tiglath-Pileser III, Shishak that we've already mentioned, and Sayamun that is also mentioned in the biblical text, including all 3 destructions that are attested in the literary sources. I put there Bible, because that's really what Dr. Deaver means. He just doesn't say so in a scientific publication. Okay? To me, that is exciting. Because of, again, collaboration that we can have with these kinds of people, we can make an impact on the work that is done. And still today, there are leading archaeologists across the country and around the world that believe that this excavation has helped the arguments over the Solomonic period and this period of history. Now, the story of our association with Dr. Deaver is not over. And later on this week, I'm going to share with you how the Lord had His hand in our lives, in Dr. Deaver's life, in doing some remarkable things But this was the beginning. This was the beginning of a long relationship that continues to this day. Dr. Deaver today is 72 years old. I just talked to him on the phone a few weeks ago. He lives in Bedford Hills, New York, and is now retired, but continues to publish. He's writing his memoirs right now and continues to have a major impact in the field. He comes out with a book every year and has published, I think, over 30 now. So he's a very well-known individual. To me, this was formative for several reasons. Why? Because it showed me on my first excavation the important relationship of how archaeology and the Bible can work together. People often ask me, what's the most exciting thing you found? It's not a gold necklace or a treasure of some sort like that. It's being able to connect biblical history with these ancient sources that we have. This is what makes it exciting. And when students today can go back to these places on our excavations, can walk over Solomon's Gate, which they do on a regular basis when we go to Hatzor, because Hatzor excavated another Solomon's Gate, right? Every morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, they walk over Solomon's Gate. They're walking on biblical history. And they're making that tangible, three-dimensional connection with that history that nothing else can compare to. And it becomes part of yourself. And you never read the Bible the same again. It's a wonderful blessing. And I want to thank you. You know, maybe today, as we close with a word of prayer, if you guys have some questions, I'll open up for some questions. Is that all right for you? I know some of you have come afterwards and you can ask some questions. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Lord God, the world of archaeology is just one world in which you are making an impact. You have written in your word that the stones will cry out. And certainly we can see that happening in many ways. We ask that as we see these things, that our faith will not only be strengthened, but that we might again be inspired to dig deeper into your word, so that we might understand your work among your people and be encouraged through that for the days in which we live. We thank you for your word, which is a light unto our path. And we pray that it would continue to shine brightly as we continue to go on through our lives into the life that matters most to come. In Jesus' name, amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International Copyright 2008, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.